I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's Valentine's Day. Love is in the air and on the radio. What are some of the keys to a good relationship, a long and happy marriage? Are there lessons that can be learned from couples in successful arranged marriages? Our guests have interviewed some of those couples and say there are things that they can teach us about commitment, about extended families, shared values, even love. And let me introduce them to you. Dr. Robert Epstein is a senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavior Research and Technology. That's in Vista, California, author of a new study, How Love Emerges in Arranged Marriages. And he's got a forthcoming book, Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too. And Dr. Epstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Reva Seth, author of a book called First Comes Marriage, Modern Advice from the Wisdom of Arranged Marriages. She's worked as an attorney and a journalist, the founder of The Mom Shift, and that's an online and media campaign to showcase stories of women who have achieved greater career success after starting their family. She's got a book on that subject coming out sometime next year. And Reva Seth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
Reva, let me begin with you because your parents had an arranged marriage. How would you describe their relationship?
Well, it's actually what got me started on the idea of looking into arranged marriages because my parents met twice and then they got married and they've been married now for almost 40 years. And it was always a bit of a funny thing for me because I grew up in a small town in New Jersey. I was the only South Asian girl. My parents' marriage was this really exotic, really fascinating, bizarre thing compared to all my friends. What made it really confusing for me was that by our junior year in high school, all my friends' parents were divorcing, and my parents seemed to have a good marriage, but it made no sense to me that they should. And so it was a very personal journey for me to start to talk to other women, and I eventually spoke to 300 women about their arranged marriage experience to see what was making these relationships work.
And even looking at your own parents' marriage, because I'm assuming it's the one you know the best, having grown up in it, why has it worked for them?
I think it's worked. I mean, partly you come into it with a different mindset. You come into it with this sense of complete commitment where you are going to make this work, and so you're able to overlook a lot of different things. You come into it also, I mean, families do a lot of background research on the other person, and so there is a lot of shared similarities. My parents have, even though they hadn't met other than those two times, they had a lot in common in terms of their educational experiences, their family experiences. And that seems to give them, it gave them a really good bond, I think, to get started in building their own family and building a relationship. And I see them now, and they still have a lot to talk about. They seem pretty happy. And yeah, I think I still can't wrap my head around how it fully works, but it still amazes me.
Well, I do want to get back to you, Dr. Epstein. Let me get you in on the subject. What got you interested in arranged marriages?
Well, you know, for the record, I'm not really interested in arranged marriages per se. And so I started to study arranged marriages around 10 years ago, hoping I could help our marriages, which we call love marriages. That is to say, I was thinking maybe I could learn something from these marriages. And I've really focused on one particular kind of arranged marriage, and that's marriages in which there's little or no love in the beginning, and then love has grown over time. And that's what I've been figuring out is how they do that. And so I've looked at couples now in, I think, 11 or 12 different cultures around the world.
And I'm assuming there are probably several features. One is, as Reva was saying, this notion, I guess, of commitment. Is that important in understanding these marriages?
Well, you know, I've looked at this point, 36 different factors and experiences that seem to lead to the growth of love. Again, my goal being to package them, you
yes.
know, for our own purposes. And yes, in the studies I've done, pretty much the number one a factor that pops up is very strong commitment, because obviously that's going to get you through the tough times. But, you know, they're also committed not just to stay together, they're committed to getting to know each other, which is just an incredible concept, really. We don't think in those terms. And so 10, 20 years down the line, they see this as still an opportunity to get to know the other person more and even to build love deliberately. And, of course, Reva's title, which you know, is half of an expression that is common in India, which is first comes marriage, then comes love, right. Which is the exact opposite of the slogan that we use.
Well, Reva, let me go back to you. And in thinking about this topic, I'm also thinking about the role that the extended family plays in arranged marriages, including arranging the marriage, and then I'm assuming a kind of commitment for that marriage to survive and hopefully be a happy one. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely, and I know that Dr. Epstein's work looks at this as well, but the support that the arranged, when you go into an arranged marriage, there's so much community and extended family support and goodwill in helping you make it work, and that's huge in the process of having children and just going through the marriage. There's just an incredible level of support around you where people are also invested. It's not just about the two of you. And I think that was a real revelation to me because, you know, in our culture, it's very much about first the individual and then a sort of insular, romanticized notion of just the two of you as a couple, which can be great in the beginning, but over time just compound any stress factors versus the arranged marriage where it's never really about the two of you. It's always about two large families coming together. And I think that helps over the long term.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Epstein?
Oh, yes. You know, the fact that there's that careful selecting that goes on in the beginning, which Reva mentioned, and there's some objectivity, you know, involved in that process. That's part of the success. And the other part of it is that strong family support. Now, look at what we do. We do something that is often the opposite. We often date someone or live with someone or even marry someone just to defy our parents. That's extremely common in our culture. And contrast that to what happens, let's say, in India and some other cultures where, you know, you have strong family support at the beginning and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now, you still have strong family support. And we lack that entirely.
And, of course, we're talking about happy arranged marriages because, as both of you were talking, I'm imagining someone that maybe didn't want to marry the person picked out by their family and the kind of tensions and problems that could create. Reva?
No, you're absolutely right. I'm usually careful to say that I spoke with 300 women. I also spoke with 300 happy women who
yes.
were keen to share their stories and, in all honesty, came from a narrow pool in terms of they were educated women. A lot of them were second-generation women. And to make the distinction between an arranged marriage and a forced marriage, because oftentimes the two are confused and they're very, very different things.
And the idea of force, of course, that you're doing something against your will, or perhaps even we think of some of these marriages where children are involved, and you want to make that differentiation, Reva?
Absolutely. So the people I talked to were arranged marriages where they were educated adults deciding to go along with their family's wishes that they meet these people and go into a marriage. So not there was no coercion in terms of what we often think of or what goes along with forced marriages where it's underage or ill-educated and that kind of thing.
Let me just give out that phone number because I'd be curious about what our listeners have to say. We are talking about what can be learned from, and I should say here, happy arranged marriages, successful arranged marriages. Our guests are Dr. Robert Epstein and Reva Seth. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dr. Epstein, you talked about commitment and this idea of getting to know somebody. But it seems to me for a lot of people, that's also dating and sometimes living with somebody. And it's not like we don't do that in this country, is it?
You know, I'm my views on that have changed over the years, Marty, because I now see the dating process, which, by the way, is very unusual around the world. Most cultures, there is no such thing as dating. I see that in part as a way of kind of deceiving the other person. If you think about dating, certainly in the early stages here, dating involves the putting on perfume and cologne and, you know, your best clothes maybe, and going out to a particular place to have lots of fun, you know. And that's not what marriage is about at all. And so there is a lot of deceit involved, and especially in online dating, which I've written about. I mean, it's just incredible how much deceit there is. There's deceit in bars. There's deceit about, you know, how much money you make or what job you have and so on. So what happens in arranged marriage is very different. There's no one wants there to be any deception. The families don't want deception. You know, they want this to be successful. It's a very, very different model.
You're painting a very gloomy picture of love, and here we are on Valentine's Day.
Well, look at the statistics. I mean, almost 50% of our first marriages fail. Two-thirds of our second marriages fail. Three-quarters of our third marriages fail. I mean, practice does not help us in the least. So we really need to take a new look at this. And you know, what I'm seeing here is there is another possibility, because the main thing we do is we leave everything to chance. We leave it up to the fates. But in most cultures where arranged marriage works well, there's just a different mindset. It's the mindset is we are in control of this process. You know, even the love that occurs is something, you know, we can build deliberately over time. That's over and over again. That's what people say in my studies, that we're doing this deliberately. We're in control. And by the way, they often think that what we do in the West is silly.
Well, that's interesting. But Reva, I'm curious about the people that you talk to, how they learn to handle things like conflict and disagreements. Are there lessons we can draw from that?
Before I jump into that, I'd love to just pick up on one point that Dr. Epstein made about believing to chance, because that for me was probably the biggest lesson, especially on Valentine's Day, that people who aren't going to have arranged marriages can take away from the interviews I did, which was this idea that, and I put myself in this category, the biggest lesson I learned from arranged marriages was the idea of taking control of who you marry, in terms of it's probably one of the most, it probably is the biggest decision you make that shapes your life, but we're so uncomfortable with the idea of systematically saying, this is what I want, and these are the factors I'm looking for in another person, because it's so unromantic and it goes against everything we think about love. That I think that's a great lesson just to highlight, I think, for Valentine's Day.
And we're almost up at a break here, so let me switch my question to you, Reva. Were you or are you in an arranged marriage?
I'm not. Ironically, I learned a lot about how to date and find what I wanted in a relationship. I met my now husband at 10 years. We got engaged after 7 dates, but it wasn't an arranged marriage because our parents weren't involved. We just met through friends.
And how about for you, Dr. Epstein? Are you in an arranged marriage?
No, but there's a lot of very very clear deliberateness that goes into what we do every single day. And so we're very happy, and we definitely feel like we're in control over love. And we're trying to make it stronger every day and just not let it disappear.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And we have some callers calling in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And in honor of Valentine's Day, we're talking about what we can learn from happy, successful arranged marriages. And our guests are Dr. Robert Epstein and Reva Seth. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
University Museums of the University of Delaware support WHYY, featuring changing art exhibitions in Old College Gallery and Mechanical Hall, and the Mineralogical Museum showcasing specimens from around the globe. Also on view in the Mineralogical Museum, rhodochrosites from the collection of Dave Bunk. University museums are open to the public. For information about the museums, exhibitions, and programs, udel.edu/museums. That's udel.edu/museums.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're wondering what to get me for my birthday today, how about making a pledge of support to WHYY and becoming a member? That would make me very happy. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Now, if my birthday isn't enough enticement, how about a pledge to celebrate Terry Gross and Dave Davies, who also have birthdays today? 1-888-345-9499-WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
Plymouth Meeting Friends School supports WHYY. Serving pre-K through 6th grades, Plymouth Meeting Friends School is a Quaker school that provides a vigorous global education in a small, caring community. Serving Northwest Philadelphia and Montgomery counties since 1780, Plymouth Meeting Friends School is currently processing applications for 2013-2014. Personal tours are available daily. To schedule a tour and to learn more about their integrated curriculum, 610-828-2288, extension 228, or pmfs1780.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dr. Robert Epstein. He's a senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavior Research and Technology. That's out in Vista, California. Author of a new study, How Love Emerges in Arranged Marriages, has a forthcoming book, Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too. Reva Seth wrote a book called First Comes Marriage, Modern Advice from the Wisdom of Arranged Marriages. Her parents have an arranged marriage, and they have been together for a number of decades now. And she's got a forthcoming book called The Mom Shift, Finding the Opportunity in Maternity, Positive Stories of Post-Baby Success. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Hannah from the Northeast to join us on Radio Times. And Hannah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My name's Hannah. I've been in an arranged marriage for 12 years. And, I mean, we're happy. We have three children. We make it work. We are committed. And I believe, religiously, we're not allowed to date. So, it's arranged marriage is the only way.
Right.
But I believe that after the marriage, I mean, like she said, like Reva said, that you have certain, criterias. You know, you want a certain husband who has this or has this kind of career, or I'm educated, my husband's educated, so when you have a lot of commonalities, you have less to fight over, diversions by any sort.
Well, that's it. No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And pretty much, you're committed, you make it work. We have fights just like every other husband and wife, and you got to sit and communicate, and I think that's pretty much what makes it work.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Reva Seth a chance to respond. Your thoughts, Reva?
No, I think that sounds fantastic. I'd love to hear more about how the process came about in terms of, did you have a sense of what you were looking for, and did your parents work with you to find the person, or how did the two of you come together?
Hema?
Well, what happens is it's more of a community thing. Girls are, we go to, we go to the mosque, we're Muslims. And so what happens is, people are well known. People know that, oh, this daughter is available. And so whoever's, available in the, in the men department and the women's, and they kind of put them together and say, well, so-and-so's, he's an engineer or whatever it might be, and she's a nurse or something of that sort. Oh, maybe these two people might like each other. And so they do. They say one person will come to the family and say, well, this boy's looking for a wife. Would your daughter be, do you think your daughter would be, willing to get to know him? And so they're able to sit and talk and get, at least see if they're compatible. If they talk two and three times and they see that, they're really not really that compatible, then, you stop it right there and, they both go their separate ways.
Well, Hema, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And what I hear, Reva and Robert Epstein, is that at least in Hema's case, having things in common, and that's not always true with all couples. I don't know if it's always true with couples in arranged marriages. Reva?
No, it's not. And one of the things that I talk about is that we often confuse the idea of having things in common in terms of shared hobbies, like I like yoga and you don't, versus shared values. And I think that's the real crux of what makes an arranged marriage work, is that the shared values are there, whether they have some of the more superficial things in common. Often they don't, but it seems to not matter over the course of the relationship, because they tend to have what our last caller referenced, where they have the cultural viewpoint in common, they tend to have religion in common, common education background. So there's a strong foundation, even if superficially they seem to don't have hobbies in common or those kind of things that we often overemphasize, I think, in our culture, at the detriment of the more foundational values.
Does that make sense
to
you?
Can I comment on this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because I've actually again, my views on this have changed over the years, and I look at my own parents and I realize how little they have in common.
Oh,
so, you know, sometimes opposites do attract. So
yes.
It turns out the key here is not what you have in common, it's the deal breakers. In other words, it's the threats to break up. That's the key to this. And so what I've done over the years is I've developed a test to try to, you know, put this down in an organized way. And it's online now at arewegoodtogether.com. And it allows you, with another person, to find out whether that person satisfies your minimum needs in a partner, your must-haves and your must-not-haves. And that's really what turns out to be the key, because so many of us marry, and then later on the deal breakers destroy the relationship. But those deal breakers, most of them were there right at the very beginning. It's just that we didn't discuss them. So the idea behind arewegoodtogether.com is to put those issues on the table right at the outset. And you actually get a very detailed report, and it shows you where each of you do and do not meet each other's minimum relationship needs.
I'm looking at something that was in the New York Times recently, an interview with a matchmaker in New York, and just quoting here, many have a quote-unquote demand list of expectations. Among them, the woman must be beautiful, have an Ivy League education, come from a good family whose members are also educated and have professional goals similar to their children. And the matchmaker said, my job is not just about setting people up, it's about educating the parents. And I guess parents, Reva, that have very high expectations.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is the one thing you can do in an arranged marriage is you can just list out what you're looking for. But yeah, I mean, there are some of these unrealistic expectations that they have to deal with in terms of everyone thinks their son or daughter is the best catch and they want the best for their children. And I think most parents can relate to that.
Does that make sense to you, Robert Epstein?
Sure. But again, it's not so much the characteristics you want, believe it or not. It's those minimum needs. Because, for example, if one person wants to have lots of children and the other person hates children, eventually that'll kill you. If one person loves the city and can't stomach the country and the other person loves to live in the country, eventually that'll kill you. Or the marriage will be miserable. So, again, I still feel strongly that the idea is to get these issues out in the open. See if you can make accommodations, which, by the way, helps people to bond. If you can accommodate someone's needs, it helps people to bond. And if you can't make accommodations and there are too many of these issues around right at the beginning, you've really got to move on.
And that's Dr. Robert Epstein, who joins us along with Reva Seth. And we are talking about what can be learned from happy, successful, arranged marriages. And we heard from Hema, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at we heard from Hannah. Sorry, I'm getting my callers mixed up. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We now have Hema joining us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment on arranged marriages.
Yes.
Not that I have anything against dating. I've been in this country for the last 30 years. I did have an arranged marriage all less than about 22 days. And this year I'll be celebrating my 30th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
So having got married within 2 weeks because my husband was going to go overseas, I barely ever got to know him, and I should say that our dating began only after I got married. So I do have to say that arranged marriages, there's a mindset for commitment, so we kind of, make sure the marriage is going along smoothly. And then I think once the children come along, we want to provide them a safe and secure family so that they can flourish in that.
Well, Hema, I'm just curious, as you said, you got married very quickly, and then the dating, I guess, happened when your husband got back. Were there some rough patches, or were there some challenging moments as you were negotiating this arranged marriage?
I think in my case, the challenges were moving overseas. I mean, seeing that both of us were from the same culture, same religion, same socioeconomic status, all of that did not pose any threat or a problem. My main problem was actually having moved overseas to the U.S., I think I was very homesick and everything was culturally different. And I think in my case, my husband became more empathetic and more sympathetic towards me. So I think that kind of bonded our relationship for the first couple of years. And then the rest was history. So I think also coming from the same background, we did not have too many challenges. And we had a kind of same mindset towards a lot of things in life.
Well,
and I think as the children grew up as well, we had other challenges facing us. But then I think when you are strong in your commitment towards each other, I think the rest is kind of easy to tackle.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times and congratulations on your long-term marriage. And Reva and Dr. Epstein, we're hearing at least some interesting trends here, the idea of having much in common. And from our two callers in arranged marriages, that seemed to be helpful. Reva?
I'd also add that I think it's the reasonable expectations, where one of the things that I really noticed that came out of the stories I heard relative to when I was single and my friends and I were dating was that there wasn't the sense that you had to find your soulmate and your soulmate. This whole concept of the one and when you find the right partner, all of these other factors in your life will get fixed. One thing that really resonated to me in the stories I heard and that I feel is underlying the two callers we had, where it's not that you don't expect problems. You know there will be. It's this realistic expectation that you're finding a life partner, someone to share it with, but they're not going to solve the other issues that you might have. And I think that's a tough thing a lot of times for us to adjust to, in terms of getting away from this romantic idea that if you love me enough, all of these things will get fixed. If you're the right person for me, I won't feel these other challenges. Whereas it sounds like both of these callers, it's not that they didn't have problems, but it was just, it's part of a marriage over a long-term period.
And Dr. Epstein, and I was running across the word free-range marriages as the opposite of an arranged marriage, but and I kind of like that actually. But do you think in the free-range marriage, when people fall in love, they confuse love with lust, and that gets them into trouble sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a very solid research showing that when you're very passionate about someone physically, you're actually blind to important characteristics of that person. That's why sometimes your best girlfriend is saying to you, wait a minute, don't you know that he, you know, blah, 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 and you can't even hear what she's saying. But, you know, we're making this whole process sound a little bit too clinical, I think. And I think we need to recognize that the love that often emerges in arranged marriages is love. And this whole process can be, over a period of time, very romantic. I asked a very prominent woman in Pakistan who was in one of my studies, was in an arranged marriage. I said to her, you know, as a matter of course in the interview, I said, when you got married, on the day you got married, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the highest, how in love were you with your husband? And she said, 0. And I said, and how in love are you with him now? And she said, 11. And I said, and how long have you been married? And she said, 44 years.
Wow. So it took time.
So there can be real, real deep love and wonderful passion that emerges gradually and deliberately in these marriages. And that's the process I think we need to learn.
And deliberate meaning the word we need to think about.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can do this. We can do this. We can, without practicing arranged marriage per se, because that'll never catch on here.
No.
But we can borrow the practices and package them and learn how to do this, learn to be a little bit wiser in who we choose, and then, you know, enter into the marriage with more realistic expectations and then build something wonderful over time. It can be done.
Let me get Michael from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. And, Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And I love your show. I've called
Thank
in
you.
Before.
Thanks.
Question I have for your guests is in regards to, I mean, arranged marriage and marriage in general is a societal condition, and it's a societal norm. But biologically, very few species are single relationship for a lifetime. So I'm more curious, you know, if how you feel about that norm, the biological norm versus the societal norm. You know, Dr. Epstein was speaking of the marriages, multiple marriages. The first one, 50% last. The second one was 75, 30%, whatever. I'm on my fourth marriage.
Are you happy, Michael?
Actually, I'm more happy now than I've ever been. then the wife I have now is considerably younger than I. And it was completely unexpected for us to even be getting along. I was friends with her father. And we met, and now, you know, happy as larks. No relationship I've ever had with anyone is as fulfilling as the relationship I have with my wife today. And I had to go through three prior marriages to get there. So, you know, I mean, the biological versus the societal plus the, you know, sometimes we don't get it right. You know, I felt the reason the first time I got married was pressure because people expected us to get married.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's Michael. Yeah. I want to only because I'm looking, watching the clock, and we're going to be shifting gears after our second break here. But I heard a chortle from you, Dr. Epstein.
Well, sure, because Michael is still in the relatively early stages of the fourth marriage. There's a study done in India comparing the love and love marriages in India to the love and arranged marriages. Of course, in the love marriages, there's lots of love at first. Gradually, over time, it decreases. That's what all the studies show in the West. In the arranged marriages, the love starts out at almost zero, gradually increases, surpasses the love in the love marriages at 5 years out, and 10 years out, it's twice as strong.
Huh. Well, Michael, good luck, and thank you for the call to Radio Times. Let me squeeze one more caller on. Looks like Wakong calling us from Fairmount. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, my name is Wakengo.
Wakengo, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question for you guys is as follows. I'm a product of an interracial and international marriage, and I'm also married myself to someone from a different culture as well, different religion. And I actually have a lot of friends who have had arranged marriages. But my question is, in terms of arranged marriages, most of them tend not to be intercultural, interracial, since most parents tend to choose someone like them. So I was wondering if you've come across any kind of shift, particularly in the United States, if there is some kind of, you know, matches that are not necessarily from the same culture when it comes to arranged marriages.
That's a great question. Let me give...
Can I respond on that? Yeah. I actually know quite a bit about that.
Sure, go ahead.
I was actually a guest last year at the last big mass marriage ceremony that Reverend Moon performed in Korea. I was a guest of the family, and it was quite a...
Wow.
Quite an event. And, you know, 25,000 people in wedding garb in a stadium was something to see. But, you know, in that particular church, which I realize is controversial, but that particular church is known for matching people up who are from very different cultures, don't even speak the same language always. And I've interviewed a lot of those couples, and I've met some who were married back in the 60s or 70s. And my gosh, you should see these people. They are as happy as clams. Those arranged marriages, as far as I can tell, work as well as other arranged marriages in India and elsewhere. And yet they're extremely diverse. And again, the main issue is strong commitment and strong community support. They can make it through anything.
Well, you know what? We have to take a short break, and we're still looking for our third guest. Can you two stay with us for a little bit longer?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
You can do that, Reva? That's great. Well, let's take very good. Let's take a very short break, and then we will get back to our conversation. And we're talking about what we can learn from successful arranged marriages. And we're getting a lot of fascinating phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, thanks for the call. And Wakong, thanks for calling us as radio as well on Radio Times. 1-888-477-WHYY. Our guests are Robert Epstein and Reva Seth. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I'm Marty Moscowain. We have a big job today, you and me. We need to raise enough money to end the winter membership campaign by the end of the day. If you haven't made a pledge of support, do it right now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Since it's Terry Gross's birthday today and Dave Davies' birthday today and my birthday today, why not give us all a big Valentine and make a pledge of support? 1-888-345-9499. Thanks so much for that pledge.
Quintessence Theater Group supports WHYY and presents Nikolai Gogol's The Diary of a Madman. Part clown show, part social satire, playwright David Holman adapts Gogol's classic tale into a masterful send-up of bureaucracy and a raw account of one man's descent into madness. The Diary of a Madman is now at the Sedgwick Theater in Mount Airy through March 10th. Tickets and information at 877-238-5596 or quintessencetheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Reva Seth and Dr. Robert Epstein about arranged marriages. And in a moment or two, we'll be talking with our third guest, Benjamin Carney. But I want to give you, Reva, a chance to respond to our caller right before the second break, looking at I guess, culturally and internationally diverse couples and whether you in your research have looked at couples in arranged marriages that have that kind of diversity.
You know what? Unfortunately, I didn't come across that many couples. I tended to have people who came mm-hmm. from the same cultural background, and that was one of their key criteria in what they were looking right. for in their partners. And I'll be honest, it is one of the problems I do have with the arranged marriage approach, because it tends to very much be focused on often, leaving aside the example that right. Dr. Epstein gave, on people from the same religious background and from the same ethnic communities.
And Dr. Epstein, I'll give you the last word here. So words to live by from people in happy arranged marriages?
Well, take control. I mean, those are the key two words here for Valentine's Day. Don't use just your heart, and certainly not your groin, you know, but really use your head as well. Take control over the process, and really, it can be done. That's all I can tell you. Mm-hmm. I've been looking at these couples for a decade now, and if you're strongly committed and you say, you know, we can do this together and we're going to build something wonderful, you can make it happen. Don't leave it to chance.
Well, happy Valentine's Day, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Epstein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Reva Seth, thank you very much as well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And we have been talking about arranged marriages, a tradition that goes back centuries. Now we do want to shift gears and look at online dating, a profitable industry that's become very popular, a very popular way to meet people and look for a partner. Joining us now is Benjamin Carney. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of California in Los Angeles. That would be UCLA. He's been there for the past 15 years studying change and stability in intimate relationships, particularly in the early years of marriage, co-author of a recently published article, Online Dating, A Critical Analysis from the Perspective of Psychological Science. And Benjamin Carney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here, Mark.
It's an interesting segue to go from arranged marriages to online dating. But do you think dating sites have become the sort of matchmaker of the 21st century?
I would say probably not. In fact, in some ways, online dating is the opposite of arranged marriage, whereas arranged marriage says, you know, here's your choice, and now you're going to try to live with it. Online dating presents people with a universe of choices and says, you know, you're in the relationship supermarket, take your pick. There's just more choice than you can possibly go through in a lifetime.
You have taken a critical look at some of these dating sites. What's wrong with them?
Well, for the most part, very little is wrong with them, because most of them deliver exactly what they promise. But some promise different things than others. So one thing they promise that they can absolutely deliver on is access to couples, to partners you wouldn't otherwise meet. And that's a promise they can totally fulfill. So if you're wondering, hey, who in this room is single and looking, you have to ask everybody in the room. But if you're dating online, you know that everybody that you're presented with is single and wants to meet you. And that's just great.
Sure.
What some promise that's a more difficult promise to deliver on is that they'll actually select for you someone who is very likely to be a match for you and have great romantic chemistry with you. And that's a promise that we were critical of, because we didn't see any data that suggested that they can deliver on that promise.
And that's what gets us into algorithms, right? The kind of formulas that these sites use to try to match people?
Yeah, exactly. So, again, we thought that often people choices is a great thing, and sites are great at it. But the algorithms, as far as we understand them, it's, you know, these are kind of secret knowledge that's not easily accessible. Basically derives from relationship science. I'm a relationship scientist, and so are my co-authors. And we know a lot about, we can predict a lot about which couples are going to do better in the future. Some couples have a better chance of success than others, and we know a lot about what predicts that. But predicting the success of a couple that's already formed is very different than predicting romantic chemistry between two strangers. And there's actually a lot of science that says it's a very different process. So although algorithms are not too bad, we can do pretty good at predicting relationship success from couples that already exist. We're not very good at predicting, in a room full of strangers, here's the one that you're going to click with romantically. The best person to make that decision is you.
I understand that. But do you also think, looking at some of these sites, that they either ask the wrong questions or they don't ask them in a way that might reveal more information? Or are you just saying that dating is different from a relationship, and a relationship, what makes a relationship work is very different from that sort of kismet that you might feel early on in a matchmaking experience?
That's pretty much exactly what we're saying. So if you think about what makes a relationship good, a lot of people can judge that based on shared values and shared attitudes and shared goals for life, and also what makes a relationship good is having a partner who has a lot of strengths, you know, a partner who's a good person and doesn't have a lot of vulnerabilities or psychological issues. But those things are very different than the things that seem to predict romantic chemistry in a first meeting. And, you know, one challenge in modern-day relationships is that we want both. We want a high-quality partner for long-term, and we want someone that we spark with. Turns out that the things that create romantic spark have very little to do with your attitudes. The things that make for a chemistry and a feeling of excitement and arousal in an initial interaction have very little to do with your goals for the future. What does it have to do with? It has to do with things that can't really be measured in a questionnaire. Sure. It has to do with responsiveness, how you make me feel when I tell you a joke, how what you say when I disclose something vulnerable about myself. Those are not things that people can tell you about when you ask them a question by themselves. Those are things you have to experience. And it turns out that romantic chemistry is something you have to experience.
Well, let me give out that phone number, because I'd be interested in hearing from our listeners, especially those that who have used some of these dating sites. And I know lots of people who have, and we'd be curious about your experience and whether your experience lines up with our guest, Benjamin Carney. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm looking at something that was actually in the New York Times recently, and a social psychologist named Dr. Gonzaga apparently does some work with eHarmony, and he did reveal, and I'm just quoting here, he said its newest algorithmic matches for couples focusing on six factors, and they are level of agreeableness, or put another way, how quarrelsome a person is, preference for closeness with a partner, degree of sexual and romantic passion, level of extroversion and open to new experiences, how important spirituality is, and how optimistic and happy each one is. The idea is that if you can tap into this, perhaps you can find a mate. Does that make any sense to you?
Makes a lot of sense. I know Dr. Gonzaga, and I'm familiar with his work, and was in the audience when he presented that work.
Oh, interesting.
The work that's been described in the New York Times. In fact, that work is not very dissimilar than research that's been done for decades and decades predicting which couples are likely to divorce or not. The first studies that predict divorce on the basis of the personality of the spouses were conducted and published in 1938.
Wow.
So we've got nearly a century of data that supports pretty much those same conclusions, that in couples, people who are more agreeable, less neurotic, people who share values, those people are more likely to stay together. The problem with the current data that Dr. Gonzaga was able to share with us is that there's no evidence that those things also predict whether strangers will like each other.
Hmm.
In fact, there's lots of reason to believe that in an initial meeting, none of those things matter. That, look, the people responding to an initial meeting has very little to do with their agreeableness or their shared values or what have you. So those are useful things to know if you've got couples in front of you and you want to know which ones will succeed or fail. It's not clear how useful they are if you've got strangers in front of you and you want to match them up with other partners. For that process, you really have to go back to behavior and interaction.
And I'm assuming, and we're talking here about first impressions, and perhaps there's been some, you know, online chat and they've gotten to know each other a little bit, but I'm assuming things like appearance and, you know, body language and what they're wearing and age and all those. I mean, I don't think those are shallow things, but the sort of obvious things are probably what can either make or break that first meeting.
Marty, you're absolutely right that in the first impression, those things, how I respond to you physically, how I respond to the way you appear to me, and how you respond to me, play a huge role, which is why when people are matched online with, and when a website says, you know, here's someone who you're going to like,
right,
that's not going to make me like them if I'm just not responding to them in a physical way when I first meet them. I've noticed that websites in the time since we've published our paper, more and more websites and phone and mobile phone apps are abandoning algorithms altogether and saying, well, we're going to provide, the service we're going to provide is a way for you to meet people in an exciting environment, or go out on a crazy date, or do something fun, and then you'll decide if that chemistry is there. That seems like probably a more scientifically valid approach.
Well, but completely unscientific in that you're throwing a bunch of people together and say, go have fun and see what happens.
Well, it's not unscientific because the available research shows is that romantic chemistry comes from an interaction, from how people behave. That's what you're responding to, is how you behave with another person. And you can't know that from a questionnaire. The only way to know that is by having the experience. That's very consistent with what relationship science is finding.
But that's also what happens at a bar, right? there you are, and there he or she is, and you see what happens.
That's exactly our point. The point that we made in our article is online dating is another bar,
right.
A more convenient bar, a bar you can visit while you're sitting at your house. Not everyone can go and visit a bar. In fact, it's better than a bar because it allows you to do a little bit of screening that's harder to do in a bar. It just doesn't select the partner for you from the bar. That's the only thing that's not good at doing.
Have you done online dating?
I haven't myself, but I have many, many friends and colleagues who have, some of whom have met their partners there, some of whom ended up meeting their partners at a bar.
Well, it is Valentine's Day after all. Let me get, looks like Richard from South Jersey to join us on Radio Times. And Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi
good
there.
Morning.
Good morning.
I have been married 3 times. This is my third marriage. The first 2 marriages were traditional. I have to say neither one of them was particularly happy or rewarding. At age 56, I was single, looking for someone, and I tried a website, Match.com. I have to tell you, it was the most wonderful experience I ever encountered. And the girl who I ended up marrying as a result of that encounter was way down on the bottom of the matches.
Really?
Was not really a very good match. I was very much into athletics and skiing and city boy, and she was a country girl, and more or less stay at home, and we are the happiest people you could imagine. I don't think a day goes by where we don't tell each other that we love each other.
Well, that's
and
great.
I'm 67 years old now, and she's 60.
Well, Richard, hold on just 1 second, because I need to just do something very quickly and remind our listeners that you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Ben, I'd be curious about your response to Richard's comment there, or his experience. Do we have Benjamin? No, we don't seem to have that. Well, let me go back to you, Richard, then. But what you're saying is that the person that you found, as you said, was on the bottom of the list, meaning didn't look like you were going to be a very good match, but you turned out to be a good match?
That's exactly the case. And And what attracted me to her, I think this is kind of important, was her honesty. In other words, her picture was not highly posed or super made up. She was very, very casual kind of a picture. And her narrative was very honest and forthright, as I did, too. And I think that's what got us together. We both were looking for truth, I guess, in a relationship, and it worked out very well. And it's still that way.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I'm just curious, do you think the fact that you were older, that you might have been looking for other things, or the fact that you've been through a couple of marriages and perhaps had learned something about yourself and other women?
I think that's probably true. You could say I was seasoned. And she was married once also. And we decided that we were married a year later after we met, or less than a year, and have been married now. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary on February 22nd.
Oh, that's great.
And happy as could be.
I'm happy to hear that, and happy Valentine's Day, Richard. And thanks for the call to Radio Time. So let me go back to you, Benjamin Carney. And we heard from our caller that it worked out online, but obviously one person's happy experience, I don't think you can extrapolate to everybody, but it's a nice story.
It's a great story. And it's an example of what online dating does right. Like, here's a guy who, a little bit later in life, might have found it hard to go to a bar and find an appropriate partner or someone that he likes. But online dating gave him access to someone, allowed him to find someone he wouldn't have found otherwise. But it's not someone he would have been matched with an algorithm. It's someone who he discovered by experiencing the chemistry that they had together. So I think that's it's a great story, and it's an example of all the benefits of online dating and all the things that it actually can provide, especially for older adults who are doing online dating more and more these days.
Indeed. Well, Benjamin Carney, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Happy Valentine's
Day. And happy Valentine's Day to you as well. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of California in Los Angeles. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And we have our intern working this semester, Katie Ricciardi, and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.